Hi, all. These are generally conversations between adults after the children have left the table. The language can be spicy and the subjects can get saucy. So if you're ready, you are listening to The Southern Fork, a podcast that hosts kitchen chats with some of the most interesting people in the culinary South. I'm your host, Stephanie Burt, and I'm always hungry to learn more. Let's dig in. The Southern Fork is supported by Charleston Wine and Food. The first weekend in March is always marked on my dance card, as it were. Although I love attending food festivals all over the country, the Charleston Wine and Food Festival sincerely has a special place in my heart. I've watched it grow and evolve throughout its presence in the city, and each year I make new connections, taste something delicious I have to share with others, and of course, have lots of fun. This year, I'm honored to be a participant and will be speaking at the Pecha Kucha event, as well as popping into as many other events as I can squeeze into my festival days. Tickets are sold out for lots of things, but there are still plenty of opportunities to join me in the culinary village and beyond. Visit charlestonwineandfood.com for more information and to purchase tickets. And if you see me at the festival, please make time to say hi. I'd love to meet you. When people find out what I do and where I live, usually this is the next question. Hey, what's your favorite restaurant in Charleston? Well, while that answer varies, and I can never choose just one, Fig is consistently part of that list. I might as well confess that now, because after you listen to this conversation with Jason Stanhope, it's going to be obvious. Jason's skill in the kitchen is also obvious. He was awarded the Best Chef Southeast James Beard Award only 1 year after taking the executive reins after Mike Latta. And this restaurant was one of the early adopters of the Eat Local movement that's so vital to the current Charleston restaurant culture. However, what makes Jason's work and the restaurant so exceptional, and it is exceptional, is its tone, this unmeasurable X factor that we delve deep into in this interview. Fig is a closed kitchen, but Stanhope lets us behind the door for this one.
Welcome to the Southern Fork, Jason.
Thanks for having me.
Yes. Well, you're actually having me. We're sitting in a quiet booth, which I've never been in Fig this much when it's this quiet. It's a Saturday morning. We can hear Meeting Street on the outside beyond the picture windows. And you're about to have a long day of prep before a long service, right?
Right.
Right. So how many hours of prep a day does it take to make Fig Fig?
Well... we have people start showing up about 7:30.
7:30 a.m.
A.m., yeah. So we have a whole a.m. crew. And
what do they do when they come in? They're getting deliveries, of course.
Yeah, we receive a lot. Some of our orders aren't quite as, like, you know, standardized as some places. So oftentimes we're waiting on a fisherman or a farmer or, you know, and all the variables that could happen. So, you know, we have two different bread deliveries, and we make it harder on ourselves than we have to, for mm-hmm. sure. Mm-hmm. But they are definitely the, in terms of if you don't have good food to work with, you can't, you know. I had this crazy Brazilian chef in mm-hmm. San Francisco, mm-hmm. and his name was Chef Almir de Fonseca. He was an old surfer that, like, walked with a limp and would scream at you or, like, drop your cell phone in the fryer or crazy things, yeah. But he always told us.
Because that there is a point of no return once it goes in the fryer.
No, it was.
No rice for that one.
No, it's done. No phone doctor will help that.
But what would he say?
The thing that, like, rings through my brain 100 times a day is he would always say, you can roll shit in sugar, but it's still a piece of shit. And it's the same thing. I mean, those AM, the AM crew has the most important job because everything that they receive has to be perfect. Because if it's not, you know, essentially every step you take from there, that product starts to decline in quality, or the shelf life starts to get shorter and shorter, or, you know, like I said, if it doesn't start out amazing, it's not amazing.
Well, how do you teach that as a chef, teaching your crew? How do you teach that level of perfection of product? Because that's something that you brought here and you've honed here through your work under Lotta before you took over as exec. But every time I've been here, every time, everything product-wise, it's just perfect. So how do you keep, how do you teach that?
Oh, man, it's hard. Do you, like...
Is it just an example? Do you just follow by example? Or do you have rules? Do you say things about certain things?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of variables. One, so, like, from somebody that does most of the ordering, like, I try not to set them up for failure. So when I call somebody on, you know, I make it very clear as to what we want, and you have to be confident about what you want, whether it's not just a fish, but we want this size fish, or asking where it came from, or when it came in, when it's, you know, talking to them about, you know, shelf life and handling and things like that. So on my side of things, I try to set them up for as much success as possible. And once the food gets here, you know, it sounds cynical, but you definitely have to, like, we receive everything in our covered backyard. And we have this big receiving table, and we spread everything out, and you just have to be, you know,
hardcore about
tedious.
It.
Yeah, yeah, you, like, go through every box, you know,
You go through every box every time?
Every box, every time, and we're talking...
So, like, Mark Marhefka, you, when he delivers shipments of fish to you, you go through them.
Oh, Mark's a little different. He's like...
Hey, Mark. Yeah, how you doing? Hey, Carrie.
He's like, you know, he's a golden god. We, like, have shrines and stuff to him.
Yes,
so
yes.
When Mark drops something off, we have the relationship that Mark's not going to bring me anything that isn't...
Perfect.
I mean, his standards and our standards are so in line, it's kind of scary. And we have the relationship that if something doesn't work out, I'll call him, and then we'll go from there. It's either a mishap or, you know, there's, like I said, with food, there's so many things that can go wrong.
So it is just that time and attention of looking at the product and understanding each product's perfection or peak, I guess I should say. So you have to kind of create a card catalog in your mind of, like, this is what...
Well, you have checkpoints with everything,
like.
Yeah. You know, and, like, fish is a good example because, like, we have so many checkpoints with fish. It's like, okay, the fish shows up. It's like, how's it packed? Is it packed in ice? Is it supposed to be in ice? Does it have ice bags on it? You know, from there you start pulling the fish out, and we put them into either iced coolers or slush bath, depending on what type of fish it is. But as you're doing that, you're feeling the fish. Is it firm? Is it soft? Are there scales everywhere? How do the eyes look? How do the gills look? How does the belly smell? Is there a smell at all? You know, you're looking for color. You're looking for, there's so many things you're looking for. There's actually a slimy fish is a good sign because they have a,
that protective coat.
Yeah, it's like a mucus of some sort that, it looks intimidating.
It sounds really appetizing. Can you say that word again?
Mucus. There's a lot of things that, you know, that's why I prefer a closed kitchen, because there are things that we do that aren't, well, most of what we do isn't romantic, but contrary to, like, all the cookbooks and shows you watch, which is kind of, we're going to go off on a huge tangent here, but which is kind of detrimental to, like, the future of cooks.
Agree.
Because...
Yeah.
They don't realize that on New Year's Eve, after the clock strikes 12 and you're cooking until 1:30 in the morning and you can't wait to go rage with your friends, that we actually have to clean the hoods and scrub the ovens. And, like, there's just a lot of work to be done. And, you know, when it comes to butchery and things like that, like, there's things that, may, you know, people need to know where their food comes from. and know that, like, especially with proteins, that there should be some level of connection there that might mm-hmm. make you uncomfortable a little mm-hmm. bit, and that's healthy. But it, 'cause it's like the, when we remove ourselves from what really happens, I think that's when we like put up these, you know, these shutters of like immoral practices and stuff. So
I do too. And I years ago when I decided not to go vegetarian, 'cause I think everybody that spends time close to those sources of protein, that's crossed your mind at some point, like, should I do this? Should I eat this thing? 'Cause I'm about to see it killed, or I'm about to kill it, or, you know, what do I do with it? And I wanted to know how it happens, and what is the ethical treatment, if, you know, which is a question for each protein that I eat, mm-hmm. you know, how do you do that? But I think that's not a tangent. That's one of the things I wanted to talk about here. I think with Fig, this is a place that I try to explain to other people, and it's hard for me to do so because there is a, how do I can't even say it without sounding sappy. There's like a love on the plate. I haven't always known you, but I've eaten your food before I knew you. But there is an immense heart for some kind of something that's not just food on a plate here at Fig. It's like a relationship between the people around you. Even if you don't know anyone in here, you kind of feel it. It's a good feeling. How do you build that? Because I feel that every time I'm around you too, and every time I see your crew around you, and every time I'm in your kitchen briefly as I quietly move around the side and go in and out and ask questions. And I always feel a little reverential about that. But it's not reverent. It's like loving, like a hug. Mm-hmm. I mean, every time I'm here, I just feel like I've gotten a big hug after I leave.
But we do hug a lot.
There's a lot of hug outs.
There's a lot of hugs, yeah. Like sometimes the owners are like, like, we're okay with the hugs, but like we are in a new age where there are like HR things and stuff. So like, just, you know, just be careful with the hugs. But I know we hug a lot. But we also, so we have the same, you know, reverence, for maybe lack of a better word, that you're talking about. We have the same respect for the people that bring us our food. And we have relationships with all of them. Sometimes it's like having a lot of relationships, mm-hmm. which can be difficult when mm-hmm. we're not good at the relationships that, you know, we have with people that we love.
Yeah.
So we're like, you know, I'm no relationship expert, but I get a lot of practice because I have, you know, 17 farmers, like three fishmongers.
You know them. You know their kids. You know where they live, where this is coming from, the struggles they're having.
Yeah. We talk a lot about, you know, personal things. And I think that that's important, for sure. But we also know, like, you know, yeah, there's struggles, the things that they deal with. We understand the financial hardships that it takes to be in agriculture, or, you know, the investment that Mark has to put in his boat every year, or, you know, how a dairy farm takes such a toll on a family because you have to milk twice a day, 7 days a week. And we know all these things, and we respect all these things. So like when we would get, you know, eggs from Celeste, when mm-hmm. she was still doing eggs, it's like if somebody would drop an egg or waste an egg.
Don't bring up the eggs and the fact that the coddled egg is gone.
Oh, man. We still do coddled eggs for people that ask. You just got to ask.
I didn't ever ask before, no. Just assume that I want one every time I'm in here.
Okay.
All right. The best egg of my life.
Yeah, you know, I mean, a lot of people around town are doing them too, so.
Not like yours.
But the coddled egg got me off topic.
Sorry.
But we do respect those relationships and what they do and how important it is to everything, especially to this culture where, you know, people don't know where their food comes from. Mm-hmm. They just buy bags or boxes of it and then hope mm-hmm. for the best. But because we're blessed with that responsibility to take care of their life's work, their everything that drives them, we do like respect like that product so much, And everybody talks about, like, oh, we're an ingredient-driven restaurant. Like, I mean, everybody's kind of an ingredient-driven restaurant.
It's kind of the point of a restaurant.
That's kind of the point of a restaurant. Right. But we are kind of different. Like, we let the ingredients kind of drive us, you know. So, like, we buy things, and we have no idea what we're going to do with them. We buy things, we taste them, put them on a cutting board, we... you know, whatever it may be, and then we get inspired by
the ingredients. So give me an example of something like that you've done, because you still do a lot of the ordering, like you were saying. So can you think of one?
Yeah, like I wanted to do something with rabbits. There's communities out there, especially in like Tennessee, where we get most of our rabbits, that you'd be surprised at how many jobs like rabbit production offers to a community. And we, so I was like, this is important. We need to get behind this. So I was trying to figure out something to do with rabbits, and I didn't need another entree. I don't know if I would order a rabbit entree, over a piece of fish in Charleston, South Carolina. Mm-hmm. But what we realized is that the rabbit came with so many different, it came so intact that it had the livers and the kidneys and fat on it and these bones that make a beautiful stock. And so we were like, how can we get all this in one dish? And so we started making this pate en croûte of rabbit. And all of a sudden, like, the whole rabbit was in this one perfect little package. And then we encase it in this, like, it's a shell that's so crispy, you can't believe it. And we put these little chimneys in it, and then we fill it up with this, like,
right.
With the aspic made from the bones. And I can literally, like, go to a table and look somebody in the eye and be like, every single piece of that rabbit was used, you know, start to finish. And, you know, that's inspiring. Greens and
just vegetables. And just the juxtaposition of that dish. I remember knowing about it and the crispiness of the outer shell with the aspic and all the juiciness of the rabbit inside is just a really fun contrast as well.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know? So there is some fun, you know, happening.
We're also, I mean, and like that, you know, specific recipe, we're like, we're preserving traditions of like things that are so important to cuisine and what we do now that people don't do anymore, whether it's laborious or outdated.
Like
aspects. Yeah, like I look at some of those things that we do, and it's not uncommon for us to spend like 6 days on a dish.
Wow.
You know, it's especially with like a lot of our sauces, you know, the stock alone we run for, so we blanch the bones day one, we run the sauce day two, we do what's called a second run or a Remy day three. Day four, we bring that all down into this like concentrated, you know, liquid that's been skimmed and coddled for the last 4 days. And then on day five, we use that base and we add the seasoning and, or the, you know, not the seasoning, but whatever, flavor profile we're looking at. And we bring that up and then we bring that down. And on day six, we reduce it to just the perfect consistency. And on day six, you're left with this sauce. So it's like, you know, planning 6 days ahead is so hard and challenging to keep up with. Or like the rabbit, you know, it's like we get them in, we have to butcher them. Then we have to make the sauce. And then we have to, or the stock. And then we, after we make the stock, we have to clarify the stock where we use this old raft. Like, I mean, making a consommé, everybody should know how to do, and most of us don't.
I don't.
Yeah.
I don't. I make stock all the time at home, and I'm like, well, I'm going to leave all that in there.
Yeah, well, there's something so magical about, I mean, if you can see the bottom of a bowl, or just, like, it's so crystal clear. I mean, my pastry chef, Caitlin, who's, like, maybe the most talented person in that kitchen.
The peach leaf ice cream.
So incredible, right?
So incredible. I can't wait for it this year.
I know.
I cannot wait.
I'm going to buy so many peach leaves this year. I don't even know why I buy peach leaves. They should give them to me for sure. I was chopping up this, we call it bunny jelly because it is literally bunny jelly. But we were chopping it up and she was like, oh my God. And she was like, it looks like, and she started going off on all these gems and things, you know. But it's true. It's like so brilliantly beautiful, and you can't believe all the steps that it took to get there, and like where it started and then having this refined product. And I think, like, you know, not to dwell on that, because we find so much inspiration in vegetables and fish, maybe more so than anything else. But that magic that you get from seeing the perfect aspic, shimmering in the sunlight is like, that is something you can't do at home. And that's something that not everybody can do or has the means to do or even the equipment to do.
Right.
And I think that is maybe the thing that I miss most about dining right now, is a lot of times there is no magic.
Right.
It's like an open kitchen, which is fine. I love an open kitchen, but I, you know, like if you ever watched, I'm biased, but if you ever watched like The Ordinary Work, like that's magic.
You're slightly biased. Yeah. Just a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. But like that's magic. They're like clean, yeah. Professional,
clean,
like
you
can't
quiet.
Believe how, you know, how, like every decision is calculated. You can see that in everything that they do. So like that's magic to me. The food, and not just at The Ordinary, but, you know, food has to like take you somewhere,
mm-hmm.
or make you feel like you can't do it, or,
right.
or it better be value.
Right.
And the problem that I, or the issues that I have sometimes with dining out is, we all pay the same amount of money for food. It's all, I mean, if you're buying good food, it's expensive. So, you know, all of the kind of fast casual places out there, like I get it and I love some of them. Like I go to Monero like twice a month with, mm-hmm. with my girlfriend. We walk there and it's incredible. But you know, there's other places out there that are like, you could spend as much money on a Sunday afternoon for a quick brunch as you could
right.
on a Saturday night at Fig. And
well, and that's what I've had people say, you know, this is I only would go to Fig because it's so expensive. And I was like, have you ever looked at the menu and the numbers? It's kind of the same as half the places in town, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, like,
and honestly, we've done a lot of things to figure out how to keep value on our menu. And if you look at a menu from, which this is embarrassing, if you look at a menu from 2011, 2012, it's pretty much the same.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, I guess that's like one of my biggest pet peeves, not to go off on pet peeve tangents, but I'm just like, if you're going to do fast casual, like I want value.
Mm-hmm.
But if I go out to dinner, like I love the showmanship of service
right.
and like that feeling you get when somebody is one step ahead of you the whole time.
It's so fun.
Oh
and
my
that,
God,
it's
yeah.
just so fun. I feel the same way. And that's one of the things with Fig is it's there's no pretension at the same time. And so you just don't know. It's kind of like a movie,
mm-hmm.
like that you don't know what's going to happen, but you know that you're going to enjoy it. Like, you know, if somebody you like is in that movie, you're going to enjoy that movie.
Right.
And so I just sit down and I ask any question I want. I get the answer. I'm just ready to see what's going to happen. You're an executive chef. You're a general. You're a general leading this team every night. And you have to lead during the day to make it through the night. How do you instill? I mean, all this stuff is really hard as hell that you're doing. How do you instill that consistency and that stamina for discipline? Or do you just attract people that already have?
Well,
those?
Yeah, I was going to say, you have to invest in people.
Some good people here.
Yeah,
I know them. I've interviewed them.
Yeah, we have an incredible staff. And you definitely have to surround yourself with people, or at least be strong enough to surround yourself with people that can do things better than you. And you have to figure out how to, like you said, instill those values in them. But at the same time, you just, I think you have to kind of believe in those people and know that they're not making, if it's a poor decision, or not even a poor decision, but if it's a decision that's not in line with your vision, it's not like a malicious thing. It may be they just don't know. I mean, I oftentimes try to teleport myself back 9 years to the first day I walked into Fig. And I'm like, man, how many bad decisions did I make in that first year?
Mm-hmm.
Like a ton. And, you know, I mean, Lotta was like down my throat, like trying to make me a better cook, a better person, you know, better whatever. And, or better everything is probably a better word for that. But you really have to like trust that people are always going to, or not always, but people are going to make the right decision based on the knowledge that they have. Mm-hmm. And so it's our job to like give them as much knowledge as possible. Like we require the best out of them, but we're also not upset when somebody makes a misstep, because we all make missteps.
So how does correction happen in your kitchen? Because it has to.
Some people are better at it than others, and it depends on the day. That whole discipline stamina I was talking about, it's like, I see it happen throughout the day. I see it happen throughout the week. I see it happen throughout the years. So there's definitely times where people are fatigued, and that can lead to maybe you know, less effective forms of discipline. We try not to raise our voice. It's just, you raise your voice and ironically people shut their ears off. So just talking to people like adults, telling them, sometimes there's no time to say, this is why I need this. And like mm-hmm. you said, it's like, you know, I don't know if general is a good title, but it is like, I was telling somebody back there the other day, I was like, unfortunately, we can't talk about this anymore. Like, democracies just really don't work back there because things have to happen right now. On the backside of that, yes, we make decisions right now, we live with it, and then we talk about it afterwards and decide if that was a good decision, and then we're more prepared for the next situation. But there are times when it's like, this is how it has to happen, and mm-hmm. it has to happen now. We can talk about it later. But I think being frank with people and being honest with people is, I mean, it sounds so cliche, but it's the only way. Mm-hmm. And part of that, though, is as a manager, or a motivator or whatever, it's your believability. Like, can people buy into what you're saying 100% because you live your brand? I think that's like one of the biggest things that's settled in for me here, is because, you know, when Chef Lada or when Adam Nimro says this is how we need to do something, like, that's it. That's how it is. And they have more information about all the variables in our world than I do, and I have more information about all the variables in our world than, say, my staff does. And it just kind of, that hierarchy trickles down, and you just have to believe that the person ahead of you on that ladder has the information. Mm-hmm. And then maybe you seek out that information so you can help make those decisions. But living your brand is everything, because mm-hmm. it makes you believable and genuine. Mm-hmm. And nobody wants
to work. And you're not a brand, though, Jason. You're a person.
Well, but everybody has a brand. Everybody
you
has...
have a persona.
Yes,
I would say. But I think you're like the most anti-brand person that I know, probably. Yeah. Because you're...
But it sounds so romantic, but there's definitely days where we'll lose it over something small. Right. You know, we all invest all this money into our tools, and somebody will use your tool and put it back dirty, and you'll lose your shit. That's the way it is. Or somebody will misrotate something or not wash a dish or do, you know, make that, make that hard decision, and that will drive you
right.
You know? Well, you know, so we always find something to nag about.
Yeah.
There's got to be something. And what I tell people, and I'm like, man, this is like a pretty like messed up reality. But if we're not like nagging about the way you cook or the food you're putting on the plate or your mise en place or like all these huge, you know, big deal things, if we're nagging about how clean your shoes are or if your apron's pressed or... if your jacket's white or if you're shaved or groomed or if you're, you know, are you washing your dishes mm-hmm. properly? If we're nagging about those things, it means you're on the right track, because mm-hmm. the more tedious the nagging gets, it means that the big picture stuff is happening. But we do spend so much time
asking questions like, what's going on with your shoes?
Yeah, or like... could you please grab a broom and sweep? You know, we sweep every hour on the hour, and sometimes before that or more than that. But we definitely, you know, if you don't sweep once a day in that kitchen, you just don't get it. You don't mm-hmm. you don't understand. We all wash our own dishes. We used to have 2 AM dishwashers that have become incredible prep machines. Like, they can crank out a prep list. Like, I mean, it is amazing. Like what they can do, and they become so invaluable to us. We've you know, promoted them to these different positions and just didn't have the staff to have to afford a, you know, an AM dishwasher. So now it's like, guess what? If you get it dirty, you wash it. Mm-hmm. And you'd be surprised, and maybe you wouldn't actually, but it is surprising that, you know, somebody's like, oh, I washed that dish. And I'm like, well, you did something to it, but it's not clean. Right. So you didn't wash the dish. So now, you know, it went from like, you need to wash your dishes to like, now it's like,
you have to wash your dishes this way.
Well, yeah.
To perfect it. Yeah.
Like, it, you know, people tell me all the time, oh, I sharpened my knife last night. I'm like, put your knife on a sharpening stone, mm-hmm. but you didn't sharpen it because it's not sharper than it was yesterday. So, you know, it's funny. Like we freak out about that stuff and about having a goal and about reaching that goal. And those are such great examples. Because in the cooking world, especially on the savory side of things, like you can mess up a little bit mm-hmm. and you can fudge it or fix mm-hmm. it or make it work. And most people don't know. Yeah. And it's still delicious food. But we talk a lot wow. about like having goals and achieving those goals and not thrive or not relying on happy accidents. Mm-hmm. And on that same token, you know, in the realm of discipline, it's like Fig is one of those places where we can't wait to tell you when something's not right. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of places out there that maybe it's for lack of confrontation or whatever, but they will not tell you when something's incorrect, or they'll start justifying things. And the example that Lotta gives me a lot is, you know, you'll go somewhere and somebody may get their a piece of fish too dark and it'll be a little black on the edge or overseared and a little dry or something, and they'll eat it, and instead of just not serving it and serving the right thing, they'll say, you know what? I kind of like my fish crispy. I'm like, no you don't, that fish is burnt, you know. Like, even if it's like tasty, it's not the goal, it's not what you right. promised to somebody else. So right. so that's having goals point, yeah. and achieving those goals mm-hmm. is maybe more important than the final product as far as longevity in this crazy world. So but it all starts with dishes. It all starts with sweeping.
Yeah. Those are two really true Buddhist Zen practices. If you wash your bowl after you're done with it, that's like a number one Zen practice. And you didn't realize you were doing that every day. Well, I could sit here and talk to Mr. Chef Stanhope all day because I just enjoy it. But I have to let him go so he can make rabbit and bunny jelly for us later. But if people want to learn more about Fig, about Jason's kick-ass rise to one-year executive chef next year, James Beard winner, you can go to thesouthernfork.com, and we'll have some images of Jason and food and Fig. Just understand that I've never had a bad meal here, people. Never had a bad meal, so thank you for feeding me all these times.
Yeah, that's our everything. Never a bad plate. It's the dining room.
That's right. Thanks so much for spending time with me today.
No worries, it's fun.
You've been listening to The Southern Fork. I can't wait to bring you more culinary conversations, but in the meantime, I have one question. Are you gonna eat all that?